Hello, and welcome to Fresh Blood, a podcast about killing it after 40, where we prove that new blood does not necessarily equal young blood. Here to discuss what it takes to have continued success through life, I'll be your host, Jolie Downs. With over 20 years of executive recruiting experience, I've learned how much we can grow and be inspired by other people's stories. I'm excited to share that with you here on Fresh Blood. Today, we are speaking with Gina Wilkinson. Gina is a former foreign correspondent, radio journalist, and documentary maker for the BBC, NPR, and the ABC, as well as other well-known public broadcasters. She is an award-winning journalist and has spent two decades working in hotspots around the globe, including the world's most intriguing and dangerous places. She has since decided to trade in her flak jacket for an author's pen, and she now writes novels. In her most recent release, When the Apricots Bloom, Gina draws on her own experiences living in Baghdad under Saddam Hussein. When she is not writing novels, she works in international development, helping to promote efforts to end poverty across the globe. I am so excited to learn more. Gina, thank you for joining us on Fresh Blood. Please, could you tell us a little bit more about your story?
Oh, sure, Jolie. Your listeners will probably soon pick up that I'm not American. I'm actually Australian. I grew up in a variety of very small towns in outback Western Australia. And that sort of trend of moving around continued into my adult life. I spent over 20 years living and working overseas as a journalist, and later with my husband working as a novelist when I reinvented myself. So I guess you could say I've been a nomad from a very early age. Actually, I've got quite strong ties with the US. I lived in the US on two different occasions. My oldest son was born while we were living in New York. Wow. And more recently, we spent 6 years in Washington, D.C. And we returned to Australia about 2 years ago. And so I'm back home now and enjoying life. Well,
oh my goodness.
As much as you can amid coronavirus.
Yes. Why you got there right before the coronavirus, huh? Mm. So just completely different world happening for you, not only for the changes for your kids, but changes in the world with the pandemic. But there's so much to unpack there. So you grew up in small back towns in Australia. What was that like?
Yeah, we moved around a lot. My father worked for a bank, and he was frequently sent to places that were under a lot of economic stress to help farmers there try and navigate that. So we were often in communities that were experiencing a lot of hardship at that time. So we moved around a lot, and I consider my home to be a town called Mora. It's in sort of center of Western Australia. It's a wheat belt town, population 1,500, no traffic lights, two pubs. And from all my travels, I've always found that the place that people nominate as home is usually the place where they finished high school. Mm. And that was the case for me. And my parents actually moved after I finished high school. And so my brothers consider a completely different place to be their hometown. Moving around. Yeah, that was definitely a different experience than growing up in the city. And since then, I've lived in very large cities, New York, Bangkok, for example. They all have something different to offer, that's for sure.
Oh, yes. Fascinating background. And what was that like for you to grow up in difficult economic kind of areas? How you've grown as a person because you had that experience?
I think the fact that I had to move around a lot definitely helped in terms of resilience. I was started off as a very shy child, and eventually I had to train myself to be more outgoing and to make the first move if I wanted to make friends, because when you're moving into a situation where everybody else is already has their social circle, they're not necessarily going to take active steps to include you in it. So I think that was something that really helped me later in life as a journalist and as, I guess, a novelist, that ability to communicate with people that I might not necessarily know that they're not a long-standing friend, that I could talk to strangers fairly easily. So that was definitely helpful. Oh, yeah. And in terms of economic hardship, I had a lot of friends living on farms, and I spent a lot of time when I was young working on farms that were under a lot of economic pressure. And I also lived in communities with large Indigenous populations who were suffering the effects of the changes that had happened in their society since the arrival of British colonizers in Australia. It was actually a good experience to see the different attitudes that people took towards each other, even when they were living in such close communities. There was still quite a lot of divides. Mm-hmm. And as a journalist, later in my life, I was living in a major city, and right-wing sort of racist politics really started to rise up. And I remember many people that I worked with saying, where is this coming from, this sense of grievance? And I think that time living in the country when farmers were under a lot of economic stress, and they would see Indigenous communities getting a lot of support from the government, and they would say, why don't we get this support, and so on, but not really looking at the reasons behind the situation or the historical context. I think that helped me understand the rise of, I guess, the tribalism that we're experiencing in our lives, and how people can not understand even what their other parts of their community are feeling, and those sort of divisions, how they can really become entrenched if there's not communication between different people in communities. And I think that was an interesting eye-opener that helped me understand movements and how society is becoming a bit more tribalized and separate. I think that was helpful. I also learned how to work as a shearing shed assistant. So always good to have another skill to fall back on, to rouse about. I learned some great skills in terms of chasing sheep, herding sheep, getting sheep organized for the shearer.
Hey, that's fascinating.
So, you know, a wide range of experiences.
And that is a unique skill. That is a unique skill that is right. Needed.
Yeah. If anybody needs any sheep wrangled, just give me a call.
That is great. And did these experiences lead to your current work in international aid? Is that kind of, was that a basis for it for you?
With my journalism, I've always looked at it as a way to try and create positive change, because I believe people need information, and information is what you need to make change. And so I've always tried to do the types of stories where I felt it could have some sort of positive benefit if people knew more about that topic. I was never really into doing the stock market reports or the sort of stuff you do when you're starting out as a journalist, where you have to cover car crashes and these very unfortunate but random events. Mm-hmm. I've always been interested in looking at stories about communities, how we can improve equality, access to education, these sort of things. And my husband actually worked for UNICEF, the United Nations Children's Fund, which does amazing work all around the world. And so I was exposed to what he was doing, helping children gain access to school, have safe water to drink, these sort of things. So I was also part of that international aid community, and I eventually, you know, started working in that area as well.
That's wonderful. Now, I'm curious, how did you become a journalist? Where did this come along in your story?
I was in high school, and I was studying physics and chemistry and all these science subjects, which sort of my parents had said, yes, do science, do maths. And then it was just before I had to have my university entrance exams. And I said, you know what? I really don't like science and math. I know I can do it, but what I really want to do is be a journalist. And my parents were absolutely horrified. They were like, oh, you'll never make any money, which, you know, probably is true, but has some other benefits. So I suddenly swapped streams about 3 months before my university entrance exam, and still managed to get into university on to study journalism there. While I was still a student, I got a part-time job working as a journalist and newsreader on a local radio station. And it just continued from there. I kept working, and eventually I was actually approached by NPR when I was slightly older, in my mid-20s. They were looking for someone to report from Australia and the Pacific for them. And I started doing that job just part-time in addition to my regular job as a journalist. When I finished for the day, I'd go and file for America. Mm-hmm. And my husband's from overseas. He's from Canada, and I had already actually spent long periods overseas. I'd spent a year in Brazil when I was 18 as an exchange student. It was a fantastic experience. Immediately after I finished university, I spent a year and a half in North America, in the States and Canada. That's where I met my husband. And he had moved back to Australia with me, and I'd been back in Australia for a few years, and I was getting itchy feet being the nomad that I am. And I said, you know what? Why don't we move to Southeast Asia? I talked to NPR. They didn't have a journalist based in Thailand, and they said from there you could cover Myanmar and Cambodia and Vietnam. So I just packed up and moved to Bangkok. Later on, about 5 years later, my husband was actually offered a job working in Iraq. Wow. And this actually was the inspiration behind the novel that I've just released, When the Apricots Bloom. It's going to seem very hard to believe, but at that time, we were actually told to expect a very uneventful posting when he was offered that job.
Wow. So you weren't worried?
No, I was. It was at that stage, it was before the infamous axis of evil speech by President George Bush. Iraq had been under international sanctions for many years. It was very isolated, and nothing happened there without Saddam Hussein's say-so. There was a very small international community. Only a few people were allowed in, mostly United Nations and diplomats. Mm-hmm. And it wasn't really in Saddam Hussein's interests to have anything happen to those people. So mm-hmm. at that time, when I moved there, I could actually walk around in the streets during the day and in the evening with probably more safety than I could have done in places like New York or London or any of the major Western cities at that time, because mm-hmm. people knew if she was a foreigner, she was probably here with Saddam Hussein's say-so, and no one was going to step out of line because of the terrible consequences, mm-hmm. you know, that any sort of infraction resulted. My husband moved from Canada to Australia for me, and then he moved from Australia to Thailand for my job, and we thought, oh, well, let's give him a chance to take the reins for a little while. And I've got to admit, the journalist in me was intrigued about the idea of to Iraq. I wouldn't have been allowed to practice my craft as a journalist. Saddam Hussein didn't allow foreign journalists into Iraq. Mm-hmm. But that's the opportunity to get a glimpse behind mm-hmm. the curtain. And Iraq has been such a pivotal place in modern history and in ancient history. To go there was still appealing to me.
What was it like?
But as I said, we were told it would be very uneventful. And basically, as we crossed the border, George Bush gave his axis of evil speech, and it soon became apparent that it wasn't going to be an uneventful posting, that it was actually going to be quite volatile and dangerous. We ended up in that situation. That wasn't what we were expecting, but I guess you just adapt. And my husband and UNICEF were doing such important work there as a journalist. I wasn't working as a journalist, but I was still absorbing information. And with the war coming, I knew that I would be in a position to report on things that other people wouldn't. I would have the background knowledge mm-hmm. that other people probably wouldn't have in the Western media, and that would be something. And I guess also we very quickly made friends with Iraqis. They're generally very warm people with a great sense of humor, very loving and open. And I guess also there was some sense of not wanting to abandon them mm-hmm. in, you know, this time when they would need people like yeah. my husband, who was working for UNICEF, journalists that knew about the context and would, you know, be interested in also an Iraqi point of view, not just reporting what Western military leaders had to say, that sort of thing. Yeah, it was a complicated situation, not quite what we thought we were signing up for, but that's life.
I can only imagine. And I could actually spend an hour asking you questions about that. So I'll wrap it up into one. What would you say were the big takeaways from you from that experience, the life lessons that you carry around in your heart now because of those experiences that you went through?
All right. I guess there's the positive and the negative. I would say let's start with the negative.
Yeah.
I eventually went back to journalism when the war started, and I went on to be a war correspondent. And I would say one of the things that I've learned is that under extreme stress, good people make bad decisions. And I think that was something that I also wanted to explore in my book, that sort of situation of how do people respond when they're under a lot of pressure? How do when they're in a situation where perhaps they have to do something against their own beliefs, how do they resist? Do they give in straight away? Do they try and negotiate a different way out, or do they just dig in their heels? So that was, I think, an eye-opener that you learn as you get older about the need to show compassion to people who make mistakes. If it's you that makes the mistake, maybe to forgive yourself, try and learn from mistakes. And looking at the more positive side, I would say that I have learned that people in different situations and different countries, where we might bake our bread differently or we might pray differently, I think at heart we share the most important things in common. We all want to be safe. We all want some sort of stability. We want love. We want to be able to speak our minds. And whether you are Iraqi, American, Australian, Thai, these are things that we all share. And I think that is a very important thing at this particular moment in time when we do seem so divided. And that's also something that I tried to put in my book, to show the similarities in what we want, similarities in our lives. Because many people would say to me, wow, Iraq, that must have been so strange. But actually, my female friends' lives were very similar to women's lives all over the world. They had to juggle work and home responsibilities. They were dealing with rebellious teenagers. One of them is always going on a diet and falling off the diet bandwagon, which is something that I can relate to. So there's a lot of things that we share. And I think at the moment people feel so divided. And that was a good lesson, mm-hmm. I think, that came out of that experience.
Oh, really good topics all around. And it's so true. That's the beauty of travel, really. It helps connect you with the world. It makes you realize that we are souls of the world. We don't belong to a certain country or certain state, a certain county or what have you. We are souls of the world, and we're all connected in the same way. And it's a wonderful, amazing lesson to learn in life and to realize. So yes, it's wonderful. Now I'm curious, because being a successful journalist, this is something that journalism is one of those careers that is seen as hard to break into and be successful in. Also a career that a lot of people are very interested in, even though I know it's one that has seen a lot of change in the industry at the moment. What do you feel has helped you be successful in this career and continue to grow in your success?
One thing that I found back in my day when I worked as a journalist was, if you were young and you wanted to get into the business, you had to volunteer your time to work at a radio station. That's how I got my first job. I volunteered to work at a radio station, and eventually a job came available and they knew I could do the job and they selected you. Sometimes people aren't willing. You've got to be careful that you're not getting exploited, but volunteer opportunities can be a good way to get experience and to show people your experience. You don't want to be working 40 hours a week for 6 months with no payoff. Yeah. But if you spend some time, I did, I think, two half day shifts a week or something like that for a couple months, and then I got a job. So I think that volunteering can be a good way to learn skills, make the contacts, prove yourself. And that's also relevant at any age. If you want to reinvent yourself, volunteering is a good way to get new skills, meet new people, and that's something that we need no matter what age we are. Journalism, I guess you also have to have some resilience. You have to be able to take criticism, because you will be criticized, and, you know, even more in this current era.
Oh.
I don't work as a practicing journalist anymore. I hung up my flak jacket when I had kids, but I imagine it would be even more stressful today with social media. From social media as much as you can, although as a journalist, you probably have to be tapped into it. Mm-hmm. It would be interesting. And I think media organizations are starting to pay a little bit more attention now to the impact that social media can have on journalists, because everybody's got an opinion on your work. And over time, we've also seen changes in the media landscape. When I started working as a journalist, it was not a sort of the cult of personality that it has become. You, as a journalist, you are meant to be out of the story. You are meant to be telling the story of the people you interview. It's not about you, it's about them. And you're just the faceless journalist, which is handy when you're in radio because people can only hear you, not see you. But I think over time, a lot of the what passes for journalism now is actually opinion. If you look at what's on CNN, what's on Fox, what's on any of the major channels, it's not journalism, it's opinion. And that's a completely different category. And one thing I've noticed with my kids going to school is that they are being educated on what is news and what's opinion. What is fake news? How do you find out if information you're told is true? And I think that is needed for people of all ages, especially, I think, people of older generations who grew up with journalism that was very rooted in fact. But it's morphed over the years, and I'm not sure that everybody is as aware of, as they should be, about the fact, you know, about how much misinformation is out there. Growing up, we didn't need to necessarily check is mine, because journalists, you know, uniformly stuck to the three source rule. You had to have three sources before you printed it or published it. We weren't talking about our own opinions. We were trying to stick to the facts, but that definitely has changed. And that's something I think people of all ages also need to, you know, keep up to date on, is how do I separate fact from opinion and plain misinformation, because that is something that I think is one of the biggest threats to us
democracy
these days. as a community as well, and understanding each other,
health,
exercising your rights in a wide sphere of things. Yes, so that is interesting. I'm so glad my kids are getting trained on that from a very sort of young age at school, to on cyber safety, truth versus opinion, or fact versus opinion. These are really important skills that I think, in a way, people of later generations, we didn't get that training, and everybody needs it.
You're completely 100% correct, and I'm glad that you brought this up. It's a very important topic, and I miss those days. Can I just say that? I miss those days when I felt complete faith in the reporters. I knew that they were reporting with all of those boxes checked before that information came out.
Yeah, that's very true. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So now you became a documentarian as well. How did that happen?
I guess I just found that your soundbite, the 30-second soundbite, which is the maximum you'll get on radio news, wasn't enough to tell the full story. Mm-hmm. And I had access to such, you know, interesting people in interesting situations, and I'd go and interview them, and I think, gee, I'd love to play the rest of this story. And so that's how I got into it. I just found the programs that were airing documentaries and said, hey, I've got this idea. And away I went.
That's wonderful. So you decided, you wanted to do it. You called someone, said, hey, this is what I want to do. This is what excites me. And they gave you the green light and you went and did it.
Yeah, I had a background in journalism. I had done my time doing hourly news. I had worked up to current affairs where you can get a couple minutes. And then I knew how to physically, I had the technical skills to put together a half an hour of radio or more. And then I just started, when I moved to Thailand, I just started pitching myself. I found out who the editors were of the various organizations. And I usually, when I started, I would call them with an idea, a documentary idea. When I first moved to Thailand, it was the start of the Year of the Tiger. Mm-hmm. And I was able to join an American team of zoologists who were actually doing a tiger census in Thailand. And we went out into the jungle, we set up infrared cameras, we slept in the jungle at to track, to get an idea of how many tigers remained in the wild. And my premise was, we're tracking these tigers. Will there be tigers left in the wild the next time, the year of the tigers in 12 years? So I already had a story idea. If you call up and just say, I'd like to do this, and I go, great, what do you want to do? And you don't have an idea, then you're probably not going to get very far. So I had an idea. I knew I could pull it off. And that's how it started. Once the editors know you can deliver, you're going to get more work.
Oh, it's wonderful. I love that. Now, I'm curious, is there a documentary that you did that has stayed near and dear to your heart?
Yeah. I think the one that was the most popular story I ever did was about elephants. I did so many elephant stories when I was living in Thailand. Everybody loves elephants. I did a lot of elephant stories. But the one, you know, that stayed with me was a story about the trafficking of children to work for begging rings. In Bangkok is a hub for trafficking of all sorts of drugs, weapons, people, animals, antiquities. All these sort of things come through Bangkok on their way to and from their origination and destination. And one of the areas of trafficking is human trafficking. And in Bangkok, you'll meet children on the streets who are, your first reaction is always, gosh, I've got to give these kids some money. But they are almost always working for organized criminal gangs, organized begging rings. These kids don't get to keep the money. And it's much better, you know, my policy was always to get them food or something else that, you know, they could actually use as opposed to money, which would end up in the criminals' hands. And I found an organization, the International Organization for Migration, who would find these children, then return them to their home communities, not necessarily straight back into their original households, because usually their parents had actually sold them. Usually they were sold. Usually what would happen is a respected member of a village, the village would be suffering a lot of economic hardship, would say, hey, I've got a great job for your daughter in Bangkok, sewing. She's going to make a lot of money, but for me to arrange it, I'm going to need, I'll give you an advance and you give me your kid. And then, so quite often they were tricked. Mm-hmm. They didn't realize what their child would be doing. But they didn't want to send them straight back into the same situation. So usually they would go to a sort of an NGO where they would stay there for a while. The NGO would work with the parents to make sure the parents had an income stream. They would give the kids an education. And if they were older, some skills like working as a mechanic or working as a cook, so these kids could support themselves and stay in their home environments. But anyway, so I was with, I got in contact with IOM. I said I wanted to do a story about children working for these begging rings. And they arranged for me to ride on a bus with children who had been picked up by Thai immigration. They were in the immigration detention center. Mm-hmm. And they were being returned by bus to Cambodia. And they were going to this sort of halfway house where they would try and reintegrate them into the community. And traveling on that bus for many hours with these kids, talking to them, learning their stories, That is something that I really was affected by. When you're doing a job as a journalist, you get put in a lot of very emotionally stressful situations. If you're doing this sort of, and you have to be like a doctor or a firefighter or a soldier, you can't be emotional at the time. You have to do your job. But when I was listening to that story later, when I was back in my office putting together these interviews with these young children. I remember one girl, she was 9 and she had been trafficked to and from Thailand already 4 times. And I remember crying about that. And that's something that I will never forget, being with them. And this, when we dropped them off at the halfway house, that sense of worry, will they be able to stay? Will they be able to make it? Or will they be like this girl that I met on the bus who inevitably ends up back on the streets in Bangkok. That was very, yes, very powerful. So many stories like that, but also a lot of inspirational stories as well. Stories of people rising above these sort of situations, overcoming the worst sort of disadvantages that you can imagine and going on. Usually these people, I find, they actually go on to help others. Right. And that's even more amazing. They take that negative experience, they turn it into a positive, not just for themselves, but for other people as well. And so that is really inspiring. So I guess as a journalist, you get the lowest of the lows, but you also see the most inspiring stories as well. So you get the full spectrum of what humans are capable of.
Yes, no, completely. And Gina, could you share the name of that organization that helps those kids for anyone who might want to donate or help in any way?
Sure. The organization that was bringing them back to Cambodia was called the International Organization for Migration. They help people all over the world. The organization they were working with was called Goat Do. It was a French organization. They ran the halfway house. It was a French NGO. I believe Goat Do means a drop of water. This was quite a long time ago, so I'm not sure if they're still operating there, but I know IOM does great work all around the world. For example, I actually ran into them many years later in Sri Lanka. They were rehousing people after the terrible tsunamis of 2004. Something like 500,000 people lost their homes in Sri Lanka at that time, and IOM was in charge of providing them with shelter. So they do all sorts of work for people who are displaced. And that's something that also is becoming so much more common nowadays as people respond to the stresses and various factors pushing them out of their homelands.
No, thank you for sharing that. Now, Gina, you've done a lot in your life. We've only just scratched the surface here. We haven't gone into the next stages and then reinventing yourself as a novelist. I'm curious, out of all the things that you've done, what do you feel has been one or two of your greatest successes and why, and what did you learn from it?
Gosh, getting my novel published, I would say that was one of my successes. It's so hard to get a book published. There are so many.
And this was a reinvention for you, wasn't it? It was a new stage.
Right. Yes. Yeah. When I left Iraq, I had a lot of good experiences. I had a lot of bad experiences. But one of the things that stuck with me, very soon after I arrived in Iraq, I was befriended by a local woman. And I later discovered that she was actually an informant for Saddam Hussein's secret police. And she was reporting back on everything I did, where I went, who I spoke to, and so on. And you know, I want to be very clear that I don't blame her at all for this. In Saddam Hussein's Iraq, if the secret police wanted you to do something, saying no wasn't an option. For many years, and still, I guess, to this day, I always wondered, you know, were we friends despite this? Or was it just an unpleasant sort of duty that she had to perform? And so that question stayed with me for a long time. And eventually I started writing a book inspired by that situation. And it begins with the moment that the secret police in Iraq arrive at the home of a secretary who works at the Australian embassy and tell her that they want her to befriend her boss's wife in order to, you know, gain access to information that she might find out. And it's told through the eyes of the person doing the spying, the woman that she's spying on, and a third person, an artist, because Iraq also has an amazing arts community. And I wanted to, you know, take that real life experience so that the start was inspired by real life. The rest of the plot is fiction, but there was a lot of my real life experiences injected into that. And I guess the great thing about writing novels is that you get to answer the questions that sometimes you don't get to ask in real life. Maybe you're not brave enough to ask the question. Maybe the person you ask the question of doesn't want to answer you, or you only get part of the story. Novels, whether you're the writer or the reader, they allow you to make sense of the world, because so often when we're living our day-to-day lives, it seems so chaotic. And there's a great saying, it's something like, fiction is the lie that reveals the truth. And this is something that I was hoping to do in that book, is to take this strange experience and try and learn from it and look at it from different points of view. I talked earlier about how good people do bad things. What do people do when they're under pressure? How do they respond? Do they give in? Do they resist? And for me, being able to write that book about a subject which impacted my life in a country that was, you know, very important, both on an international level and on a personal level, that was a great achievement for me. And there were many times when I wondered if my husband would be the only person who would ever get to read it. So, you know, seeing it get onto the bookshelves in the US, in the UK, in Europe, in Australia, that has been really amazing, because it took, you know, I got quite a lot of knockbacks and so on. You know, it certainly wasn't I just knocked on the first door and they said, yeah, we'll put it out there. It was a lot of work to find an agent to get it actually onto the bookshelves. So for me, that was great. And also to have another career, to be able to change careers was good, because both my kids have some special needs. One of my kids is on the autism spectrum. One of my other kids has a lot of learning disabilities, so they need a lot of extra help. And being a novelist gives me a bit more flexibility. I'm my own boss. Yeah. So if I need to change my hours, especially during the COVID lockdowns, having our kids were at home, and there was no school for a year almost.
Yes.
So being able to work when I could, but also help my kids, having that sort of control over my working day was a great, I guess, benefit for me.
Oh, yeah. Oh, we can only imagine. Yes. Okay. Yeah. Just in general with the pandemic and with the kids, that made it all so difficult. But you add some special needs in there. I can only imagine how having a career that allows you to make your own hours and be flexible with your family, what a gift that is for the family overall.
Yes. Yeah. And I'm also very lucky that my husband also is very flexible and helps out as well in all the spheres of with the kids, supporting my writing. Like I said, but there were many times where I wondered if he'd be the only person who read it. And he definitely read it more than once. So I'd rewrite it. Can you check this again?
And I love that. And thank you for sharing that it wasn't easy, that you had to knock on a lot of doors, that you had to be persistent with your goal in order to get where you wanted, because that is such a key to reaching whatever it is that we're aching for. And being honest that it isn't easy, but if you keep going after what it is you want, you can get there, is something that we all need to keep being reminded of and keep seeing in other people. So now
yeah,
I'm curious.
Sure.
What about the flip side of it all? What about a time you failed or had a really big mistake or obstacle or challenge? And how did you deal with it? And what did you learn from it?
Yeah, I would say for me, I would say, you know, trust your gut is a lesson that I wish I had learned earlier in life. Also, learn where to set boundaries. When I went back to working as a journalist in Baghdad, I was offered a job working for the ABC in Australia as their Iraq correspondent. And I ended up in a situation that, even though I was a very experienced journalist, the situation I ended up with was dangerous and just too much for any one person to handle. I was a radio journalist, but when I arrived, they said, oh, and by the way, we want you to do television. Oh, and we want you to be your own camera person. I had no idea. I had no experience of TV. So I was like, okay. Not realizing that I had just signed up to do three people in a war zone on my own. And as a woman working in a war zone, you've got also additional pressures on you. And I feel like I did some of my best journalism in Baghdad, but I also did some of my worst. And I really wish I had learned to set boundaries and say, no, I'm not going to do that. No, I'm not going to work for 3 days with no sleep, because that's when you make errors. I'm not going to, you know, work for months without an afternoon, even an afternoon off. I think that is something that you learn as you get older.
Yeah.
To say no. And when I eventually did learn to say no, I found that I got a lot more respect. When I was younger, I was raised to never say no to a task or a challenge, to just keep going. But you also, there's persistence, but then there's also setting realistic boundaries for yourself and not driving yourself into the ground.
Yeah,
so you're in a position where you make mistakes.
So
and yeah, I remember after Iraq, when I moved to Sri Lanka, I was the only journalist in Sri Lanka when the tsunami hit. And
oh, wow.
My husband actually was in hospital at the time with dengue fever in intensive care.
Oh,
and I remember the work was just rolling in and rolling in, media organizations from all over the world calling me. And about, you know, 24 hours into it, I hadn't slept. And the only time I'd taken off was to go quickly down to the hospital, check my husband, come back. And I remember someone called and I said, you know what, I'm going to be taking my phone off the hook for the next 4 hours. I'm going to lie down and have a rest. I knew I had too much adrenaline. I wasn't going to be able to sleep, but I was just going to lie down and pace myself because I knew, you know, I had learned from Iraq that you just can't keep going and going. And I knew it wasn't going to be a 24-hour or 48-hour story. It was going to be something that continued on for months and months. And they seemed so surprised. And they were like, you're going to what? And I'm like, I'm going to take the phone off the hook. And I'm just going to rest for a few hours. And they were like, oh, okay. And you know what? I got a lot more respect after that from them. And that was a real eye-opener that I could say no. Mm-hmm. And so I guess setting your boundaries, pacing yourself when you're under a lot of extreme demands is something important that you can take away from negative situations, I think.
Really big. And I think this happens a lot with women too. I don't know if this is true, but I would imagine that perhaps as a woman in a war zone, were you feeling like you had to prove yourself a little bit more too?
I'm not sure if it was attached to being a woman, but that definitely made my job more difficult. Being a woman, in terms of getting respect, I guess, from some of the people I was dealing with, some of the people I was working with. It did make life more difficult, that's for sure. And also things like physical safety and sexual harassment, they are big concerns for, more of a concern for women in the field, in those sort of environments, I think, than they are necessarily for men. It can go both ways. In some situations, you'll get treated more kindly because you are a woman. You'll get access to power brokers who may assume that you're just the little woman and they don't have to worry about you. And then you can pull out your microphone and smile and go, and then would you answer this question, you know, that everybody's been wanting. So it has negatives, pros and cons. I think sometimes I've been granted interviews where they thought, oh, this will be easy. It's just a woman. And I'm going to ask questions just like anybody else. So I guess sometimes you have the element of surprise when their expectations, they're going to have an easy ride or something like that. But yeah, I think there's pros and cons for sure.
Yeah, that's actually very interesting. I didn't think of it in that way, but yes, there's a lot of both sides on those types of things. Now, how did you push through your difficult times through all of your various iterations of your career?
Yeah, I would say actually writing has been really helpful. When I left Iraq, I actually ended up being diagnosed with PTSD and depression. You know, the PTSD would stem from things like I had been working for the United Nations prior to the war, and my workplace was destroyed by suicide bombing. My closest friend died in that, and 22 of my colleagues. And also just that whole being in a war zone is not something that you can walk away from unchanged. No. And after Iraq, we moved to Sri Lanka, and I tried to get some professional help. There was only one psychologist on working on the island. And I went to see her and she said to me, I don't think this is a long-term strategy, but she said to me, when you are plagued by recurring thoughts, write down what's keeping you up at night, write it down on a piece of paper, then screw it up into a ball and throw it away. And I actually found that to be surprisingly effective, I think, in the short term. Mm-hmm. But then I started writing a book. This is my first, it was like a memoir or more narrative nonfiction. It was, I guess, the story behind the story, writing down what happened in Iraq and all of the various things that happened to me in Iraq. And it had seemed like such a chaotic experience where I had no control. And when I wrote it down, I was able to connect the dots and see how things played out, why things played out the way they did. And I found writing to be very helpful in that way. And when friends of mine have undergone various, you know, tragedies, losing a child or suddenly losing a spouse, I tend in those situations to send them a journal and just say, you don't need to touch this now or any time, but if you want to, I always found it helpful to write things down because you can write things down that you might not want to say to other family members who are also suffering. One thing I've learned from as a journalist, I've spoken to a lot of people in grief. And as a journalist, I found people often say, oh, you're a coffin chaser or whatever. But in my experience, people actually wanted to talk to me.
Yeah, they did.
Because they wanted to honor the person that had been lost, and they didn't want to talk to their family necessarily because they didn't want to upset them. Mm-hmm. So people stay silent because they don't want to upset other people who are other also grieving. But sometimes when you put it down, when you talk to a journalist or when you put it down on a page, you're talking to a stranger. You can say the things that you don't want to say to anybody else, especially if you're writing. You can say things that you would never share with anyone. Maybe you're angry with someone who's passed away from, I don't know, say they were a smoker or something, and you've been trying to give them up smoke, get them to give up smoking for 20 years, and eventually they die of lung cancer. You're going to feel some anger as well as loss. You can write these things down and get them out. And I know one of my friends, she wrote a lot. Another friend had just lost a baby, and she wrote a letter to her child. And I think that sort of thing can be very helpful if you can articulate what you're feeling and put pen to paper. So in all, you don't have to be a novelist, you don't have to be a journalist, but in your own personal life, if you're undergoing some stress, writing about it can make sense of it, and it also can relieve you, I think, of some of that burden.
I completely agree. I've lost numerous people, and the most recent, it was the first time I started writing after in that grief period. And I have to say, you're absolutely right. It was cathartic. And it allowed me to, when those strong emotions came up, it allowed me to have something to do with them. I would write them down. And it was this outlet that was a release, because I was able to use an outlet rather than just having it bottled up and with nowhere to go. Because as you said, it's not always easy to talk to even your family members, or it's not always easy to talk to other people. And a lot of times it is almost easier to talk to someone like a journalist, someone who doesn't know the family, and you can just open up about everything. So I completely agree. I would never call it a coffin chaser. If you're willing to talk to people about their loved ones.
No one's ever said that. I've seen the word out there, and or ambulance chaser or whatever. There's that image of journalists, preying on people who are grief stricken or whatever. But that wasn't my personal experience. I guess it's also the way you do it. You've got to be respectful, and if somebody says no, you need to respect that as well.
Yeah. Now, I'm curious, out of everything that you've learned through all of your travels, experiences, what is something that you feel has brought the most benefit to your life?
Oh, gosh. The most benefit to my life. For me, I would say the most benefit I've got out of my travels has been all the amazing friends that I have got to make, been able to make in all different parts of the world. For example, Iraq. When I left Iraq, this was early, turn of the century, 2000s, I think, 2004. There wasn't internet. There wasn't even working phones. There was no mail. So I left not knowing how I would really stay in contact with my friends. Mm-hmm. And yet 20 years later, I guess this is the positive side of, social media and the internet. We have been able to stay in contact. And actually, several of them proofread my manuscript for my book.
I love it.
Really wonderful to check that I had all the details right, mm-hmm. and helped me with research. And we have been able to stay connected. And the sort of life I've lived is I've had some sort of extreme experiences, and I'm able to stay in contact with people who have shared those experiences. Sometimes it's hard for people to really understand what it was like, but I've got friends all over the world who have been in similar situations. And when you do go through war, I think especially, or some sort of terrible disaster, that bonds you in a way. Even in your regular life, if you go through some traumatic event with a group of people, you are going to be connected to them in a deep way. And I would say for me, the best thing has been this friendship of people who I've shared a lot of positive and, not so positive moments with, from all different backgrounds, who have, shown me different ways of looking at the world, who have opened themselves to my way of looking at the world and been ready to make me part of their lives, because I was usually the one, you know, appearing from the distance, suddenly arriving on the scene, that have opened their doors to me. And that, I think, is one of the things that I cherish most, I would say, would be these friendships that I have been able to make over the years all over the world and keep. That's a real, blessing there, is to be able to have friends from all these different places and times and still stay connected.
Beautiful. Yeah. I love that. Now, what about your definition for success? I'm curious, what is your personal definition for success? And based on that, what do you believe is key to having continued success throughout life?
Oh, wow. I guess a personal definition of success would be being able to support yourself with doing something that you get satisfaction from. Also having a support system. That's also something that I would consider essential to my personal success. I would say there's a couple different things that are key to having success. That's flexibility and the ability to adapt to changing situations, resilience, persistence, but also knowing where to set boundaries and making sure you're taking care of yourself, and that you're not consumed by pleasing other people all the time. I guess that would be a recipe. Yes. I think that might be. Like, I don't think I'm any sort of wise woman, so take that with a grain of salt. That's definitely opinion, not fact verified. Opinion versus fact. That's definitely in the opinion category.
I can say that it jives with a lot of the opinions out there. So the category, it's building up. It's a good one. So other than that, there are a lot of people out there right now who are struggling. We're still in a pandemic. There's a lot of changes that have been happening. There are many people over the age of 40 who are trying to find the right next path or the right next opportunity, and they're feeling a little scared and they're feeling a little struggle. Is there any advice that you would give someone in that type of position?
This too will pass. It's not all sunshine and roses. I think everyone knows that. Mm-hmm. And even the worst situations, you might not emerge unscathed, you might not emerge unchanged, but you can get through it and eventually you will feel better. I've actually got a work by a cartoonist in Australia, he's very well known, called Lunik, and I've got something on my bathroom wall and it says, it's titled Life Ache. Mm-hmm. And it's a person is in a park and they're looking all sad, and it says, life ache, it's unavoidable, it's incurable, or it's a terminal or something like that. And then it's got that same person lying under a tree with a flower, and it says, you can't cure it, but you can manage the symptoms. And, you know, I think if you have gone through some sort of traumatic event, you're never going to be 100% the same. It's always going to impact you, but you can learn to manage the symptoms. You know, you can find joy again, even though it will take time. Time is a great healer, and I guess you just have to have faith in that.
Yeah. Thank you for that. Managing the symptoms. That's a really good reminder for everyone. Mm-hmm. So this has been wonderful. I really appreciate your time, Gina. Before we go, is there anything that I haven't asked about or anything that the listeners should know about as far as where to find your books, where to find information about you, anything along those lines?
Sure. If you would like a copy of my novel, you can get it at any bookstore. If they don't have it in stock, they can definitely order it in. It was Target's book club pick of the month earlier
Wonderful.
This year. It
is Ooh, book club,
Costco.
Book people.
Yeah, it's Costco's buyer's pick, so you can get it at Costco. It was BuzzFeed's most recommended. They put it in the historical fiction category. Ooh. Not sure what I think about that, but it was most recommended, so I guess that's good. You can also find it online at Amazon or any of your online retailers. I'm also a big believer in your independent bookstores in your local community. So if they don't already have a copy, I know there's a lot of there's a lot of them out there. If they don't have a copy, just ask them and they can order it in. And if you want to stay in contact, I also have a website, ginawilkinson.net. I have a newsletter that you can sign up for. I send it out maybe once every 6 weeks or 2 months. Usually I open my audio vault and I include a story that I've done sometime in my past. I did it during the lockdown. I started the newsletter and it was a way for people to travel without leaving home. And maybe the occasional shot of my cat. I'm not sure if you are aware of the strong connection between book lovers and cat lovers. Oh, certainly there are some dog lovers out there, but the cat connection and just what I'm reading, what I would recommend it. Any other. Occasionally there's a cocktail recipe.
Wonderful.
So, yeah. That's.
And we'll include those in the show notes too. We'll make sure and have those links in there. So excellent. Before you go, I want to ask you my last question, just because I like to hear what people answer it with. What are you sure of in life?
All right. My children's love. my love for my children. They get up every morning with a smile on their face, at least until I mention homework or putting your plate in the dishwasher. But gosh, what is my most sure of in life? Oh, that's such a hard one. I think that we need a connection. Yes, we need human connections. So don't give up on human connections. That's, I think, very important for our health and well-being in so many ways. Keep making those human connections.
100% agree. Thank you so much, Gina. It's been wonderful.
Oh, thank you. All right, Jolie. Have a great day.
You too. I found Gina's story fascinating. She has seen and experienced so many different things during her life. Growing up, she moved around with her family a lot, which taught her core skills that have helped carry her through her life and career. As Gina shared, she was naturally a shy child, but she wanted to make friends. And being the new kid in town, that did not lend itself to easy friend making. So Gina had to train herself to become outgoing. Gina taught herself how to take the active steps to connect with others. She learned how to communicate to different people and talk to strangers easily. And this has served her well throughout life. Learning how to connect and communicate with others is a huge key to success and fulfillment. While this comes easy to a certain people, for a large percentage, learning how to connect with others is extremely difficult and anxiety-producing. I have dealt with social anxiety for most of my life, and I have had points where I have found it a great struggle to connect. When we moved to a new town as a new family, we did not know a single soul. I raised my boys during those early years very much alone locally. I had to drive an hour and a half or more to see family or friends. And after a few years of constant travel or visitors on the weekends, I knew it was time to find my own local community. I decided to make myself a plan. I outlined what I would do, where I would go, and how I would volunteer over the course of the following year. I made myself go to meetings that I did not want to go to. I made myself participate in events and speak up in various situations that I never would have participated or spoke at. I made myself introduce myself when I would rather shrink to the shadows. I made myself show up over and over and over again when all I wanted to do was stay in my safe space and feel comfortable. These were very conscious and forced decisions. Each time I was faced with one of these situations, and I want to be very clear here, I did not want to do it. Really, in that first year, there was very few things that I actually wanted to do, but I made myself because I did want the outcome. So I deployed the best strategy that we all have at our disposal at any time. Fake it until you make it. And I showed up. I faked it. And I slowly started to develop friends. I slowly started to make those connections. And over time, they grew and grew until this beautiful, large community of support and a newfound family was created. You don't have to be a certain type of person to find or build your community. You can simply make the decision that this is what you want, create a plan of action that includes showing up and being present with no excuses, and then execute. Stay the course, finish the plan, and you will find your people. I commend Gina for making her decision to switch from math and science to journalism right before entering college. As she shared, her parents were not happy about this decision and tried to talk her out of it, but she stayed true to her own wants and desires, and therein is the crux of Gina's success. Gina took the time to listen to her internal voice. She made the decision to stay true to her own authentic self, and because of that, she has successfully traveled down every path she has chosen for herself. I commend Gina for having the courage to listen to herself. Gina has lived in Australia, Brazil, the United States, Canada, Bangkok, Sri Lanka, Iraq, and possibly more. She's lived among peace and she has lived among war. She has learned a lot about humans, and I appreciate what she shared with us. As she said, under extreme pressure, good people will make bad decisions. When you are put in an unfathomable situation, people will do things that they never could have imagined. We all need to have compassion when people make mistakes. If you make a mistake, spend time reflecting and learning from that mistake, and then forgive yourself and move on. Do the same with others. Talking with Gina about this, it made me think of an excerpt in The Art of Forgiveness, Loving Kindness and Peace by Jack Kornfield, where he describes an African forgiveness ritual. When a person acts irresponsibly or unjustly, he is placed in the center of the village, alone and unfettered. All work ceases, and every man, woman, and child in the village gathers in a large circle around the accused individual. Then each person in the tribe speaks to the accused one at a time, each recalling the good things the person in the center of the circle has done in their lifetime. Every incident, every experience that can be recalled with any detail and accuracy is recounted. All of their positive attributes, all of their good deeds, their strengths, their kindnesses, they're all recited carefully and at length right back to them. The tribal ceremony often lasts for several days, and at the end, the tribal circle is broken and a joyous celebration takes place, and the person is symbolically and literally welcomed back into the tribe. I think this is beautiful and something that we can all learn from. The next time you make a mistake, focus on all the attributes that make you great. Think about all the things that you are grateful for within yourself. And the next time someone else makes a mistake, give them that same kindness. Remind them of all of their good. And let us all move forward with our days in gratitude and unencumbered joy. After all, as Gina shared, regardless of who you are or where you live, we all share the most important things in common. We all want love. We all want safety. We all want stability. We want to be accepted. And we all want freedom. There is an invisible cord connecting us all. When you strip away the layers, at the core, you will find understanding that every soul can relate to. Travel truly is the best form of education. Travel teaches us. Travel opens up your heart, making you understand that skin color is like clothing, irrelevant in the substance of a person. Travel opens your eyes to the ways we all communicate and relate to each other that transcend language, culture, and location. Travel strengthens the mind with understanding, with learning, with expansion, leading to new ways to see the world around you. Travel connects you to humanity, finding your family of souls that knows no borders. Please be sure to carve out the time to travel. Take the time to connect. Spending money on travel will only make you richer. Gina had great advice on how to break into that job or industry that you've been wanting to be a part of. Volunteer. Volunteer your time and work for free in the industry you want experience in. You spend a couple of months learning the new skills, making contacts with the people in the industry, and proving yourself, and you can open the door into where you want to be. Gina used this method to leverage her own career, leading to becoming a successful journalist, which laid the foundation for her becoming a documentarian and later a novelist. Her winning formula for success? Support yourself doing something that you get satisfaction from. Be resilient and persistent. Be okay with and learn from criticism. Stay flexible and adaptable, and know when to set your boundaries, all the while remembering to take care of yourself. I also greatly appreciated Gina bringing up fake news and the importance of understanding what are facts and what are opinions. The overabundance of misinformation that is out on the internet is absolutely the greatest threat we are currently facing today. It is a very real, very literal, and immediate threat to our democracy. I beg each and every listener to do their own due diligence in researching with verified, trusted sources anything they are going to believe to be true. When checking the news sources, try to stay with the sources that stay neutral. Those such as Reuters, AP, Bloomberg, NPR, Wall Street Journal, The Hill, Newsweek. These are publications that lean on fact versus opinion. Now, Gina had great overall life advice peppered throughout our conversation. When she was struggling with PTSD and depression, she was given advice to write down what was bothering her and then crumple it up and throw it away. This is a great practice to use to help purge your thoughts in the short term. And what Gina found was that writing helped relieve the overall pressure in the long term. It's a release that allows all of the emotions bubbling up a place to go, rather than percolating and bumping around inside, making you feel on constant edge. Writing allows you to make sense of the world and your own story. You start to see the connections in your own life that led you from decision to decision. Your own life patterns emerge and become clear with understanding. It is a gift that you can give yourself with a pen, a piece of paper, and a little bit of time. Write your story and let it reveal your truth. As Gina shared, there is no cure for life ache. Life will happen and there will be pain, but we can manage the symptoms. We can be aware of what is happening. We can get help by talking with loved ones, talking with strangers, or talking with a therapist. We can journal and work through our feelings and emotions. We can proactively find things to feel grateful for. We can meditate or pull out any one of the many other tools available at our disposal. We just need to know that this too shall pass, and eventually you will feel better. So if you are experiencing a time of life that is holding ache, hold on, have faith, manage the symptoms, and let time do its healing. You will find joy again. Finally, Gina shared the importance of trusting your gut and learning where to set your boundaries. You must take care of yourself, and only you know where your limits are. Many of us tend to do and do and do for others without stopping to ask what it is that we need for ourselves. We owe it to ourselves to honor our own needs. After all, when we take care of ourselves, we are able to take care of others so much more successfully. It is okay to say no. It is okay to say yes. What is important is that you are honoring your own internal voice. And that is my wish for us all, that in whatever choice you make in life, you are listening to yourself and always honoring your own voice. Until next time. Thank you for joining us on Fresh Blood. Please subscribe and follow us on all streaming services, including Apple Podcasts, Amazon, Spotify, Google Podcasts, and Player FM. You can also follow us on Facebook and Instagram at Fresh Blood Podcast. I would love your help in spreading these stories and important messages. Please give us a like and share with a friend. Your help is greatly appreciated. I hope you make today a most fulfilling day.